Our world is more connected than ever. The face of America is becoming more diverse, and we're seeing those changes here in Utah. This is Cultural Connections. Hear from our many cultures and the issues that affect all of us. Now the host of Cultural Connections, Nkoyo Iyamba, on KSL News Radio, 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We're talking to three Latter-day Saint authors who are writing to further the conversation on the changing cultures within Mormonism. And today we have to be, we're privileged to have with us here Russell Stevenson. He is author of For the Cause of Righteousness, A Global History of Blacks and Mormonism. We also have Tamu Smith, who is the co-author of Diary of Two Mad Black Mormons. And we also have with us Margaret Blair Young, screenwriter of Heart of Africa, and she's also one of the co-authors of Standing on the Promises. This is the trilogy of the history of Black Mormon pioneers. And you can find her revised expanded version published by Zarahemla on Amazon. And also you can find Diary of Two Mad Black Mormons at Deseret Book, published by Deseret Book. And also For the Cause of Righteousness, A Global History of Blacks and Mormonism, you can find that. It's published by Greg Coford Books. Thank you all so much for being here. I want to start off by saying all of you are writing to further the conversation of the changing culture of Mormonism. What does that really mean with you? And I'll start with you, Russell Stevenson, since you are one of the newest authors here in the group.
For generations, the Latter-day Saint community was perceived by and was in many ways, in fact, a profoundly white religious community, a community that owned its whiteness, that often celebrated its whiteness. In the late 19th century, you have LDS leader George Q. Cannon telling people that the Utah Territory was the whitest of all the territories, and it, you know, could be seen as a haven for those who, you know, want to get away from miscegenation and interracial unions. But you know, as we're entering the 21st century, as we have moved beyond, you know, the days of the priesthood restriction against those of African descent, we're increasingly seeing that the LDS Church has become a community of a number of diverse ethnic groups. You have a strong LDS presence in Nigeria, 120,000 members strong. You have a strong presence in Ghana. Of course, Brazil is one of the epicenters of the LDS Church in South America, and African influence is prevalent there. So as the church becomes an increasingly global faith community, it's essential that white Latter-day Saints recognize it as such. We can't just continue to believe what we once thought we could believe. We can't see Mormonism anymore as a Utah church.
And Margaret, as you are Caucasian and are a historian, and you've been writing on African-American pioneers, but not only that, but I mean, you're writing and your works and your screenplays have gone global. What does that mean to you in terms of what Russell is talking about? I mean, does any of that resonate with you?
Oh, absolutely. I'm especially looking towards the future. I was just in a meeting with a member of the 70 talking about some phenomenal programs going on in Africa. And I'm imagining, I was in the Democratic Republic of Congo in August shooting B-roll and doing location scouting. And I saw there that, oh my, we are on the threshold of this nation really rising to itself, of the young people especially taking command and making, it's already the richest nation on earth, having it live up to its destiny. And as I was in this meeting listening to the things that the church is already doing, you just have no idea how the church takes poverty, worldwide poverty, how seriously it takes it, and the remarkable programs for education, for empowering the people of all nations. My realization, I will be 60 in June. I grew up in a predominantly white world, but I have a full realization that a decade from now, the church is going to look much different than it does at this point. We will have a temple in the Congo. My focus right now is in the Congo. The fact that in the capital city, where there are between 10 and 12 million people, there are seven stakes and a temple is ready to be built. That, of course, was not even a possibility until I was 23. So changes are huge and they are continuing. The wave is cresting.
And Tamu, as the co-author, one of the authors of Diary of Two Mad Black Mormons, I'm sure that you see this cultural shift within Mormonism and actually just beyond race.
I do see a cultural shift, but I also see I see the conversation taking place, and I see that we are included in the conversation, meaning that the conversation is taking place and people are willing to at least acknowledge us while they're having the conversation, we've yet to be invited to take our place at the table to have the conversation. And I think that what I, myself, and Zandra, the co-author of Diary of Two Mad Black Mormons, have realized is we're not going to be invited. We just have to go sit down and partake in the conversation, because people will, they love to talk about you and discuss you, but you are in charge of telling your story and sharing your, you know, sharing your perspective. We're not going to be invited. We just have to go and take our place at the table.
Who are the we that you're referring to?
When I say we, I mean those of us who feel like we have been marginalized, those of us who feel like we are standing outside of the circle, watching our lives be discussed. Black, white, Latin, Polynesian, we have to take our space at that. We have to, there's space there. We have to move in and sit there.
Russell, as Tamu was talking about the space, does any of that resonate with you?
Absolutely. And sometimes white authors talk about, you know, giving voice to marginalized communities. And that particular phraseology has always rubbed me wrong, because they already have a voice, right? The question is, are white Latter-day Saints creating a space in which that voice can be heard? Have white Latter-day Saints marginalized that voice, and not in a malicious way, but out of maybe ignorance, a mere oversight, or, you know, in some cases, a discomfort with the fact that a story that doesn't match their own is being told and is being allowed at the table? So that is the responsibility of white Latter-day Saints, is not to give voice, but to step back and allow those voices to be heard.
Well, let me take it a step farther. What about Latter-day Saints as a whole? So not just white Latter-day Saints, but Latter-day Saints as a whole, where there is this culture of Latter-day Saints, and somebody that comes in with maybe a bunch of tattoos and rides a motorcycle, or somebody who is a single mom and decides to adopt a child, you know, without being married. I mean, what about that type of culture? Does the discussion on race within the church help lend itself to other types of cultural shifts within the LDS Church?
We tend to, as Latter-day Saints, and I think unknowingly, establish a certain level of, like, cultural hegemony. We expect that Latter-day Saints are going to look a certain way, right? They're going to act and talk and dress in a certain way. And then when somebody or some group ends up diverging from that, we feel uncomfortable with that. And we may allow them some kind of marginalized place, and we may ghettoize their experience. Okay, you know, they're allowed into our community, but let's make sure we understand their place.
Okay,
right?
Well, let me push back a little bit, Tamu.
I want you to explain what ghettoize means, because that is, I'm like, what? Wait, let me take my earrings off.
right. No, I mean, throughout American history, you see the white, you know, white establishment, you know, create these economically depressed areas within the cities, and what ends up happening is, you know, these marginalized communities end up living at the mercy of the white powers that be. And the same kind of dynamic exists within, you know, I would say, any kind of white establishment, including the Latter-day Saint community.
Let me just push back a little bit. You are a Caucasian male, and so you come from that perspective. But the book that you've written, co-author Tamu, Diary of Two Mad Black Mormons, how have you felt that's been received? I mean, that's culturally different from anything that I've seen at Deseret Book. So how has that been received?
I actually think that it's been received well. I think that most times when you can speak the truth, and I will say this, I think that there is a space that has been provided for black women. It's easier sometimes for black women to say the hard things. It's easier for us to do than it is for black men. And I think that it's more palatable when we do it. But I also believe that when you say something and you can say, you can sandwich it in a way that there's some humor, then people are more willing to acknowledge it. And I think that when you talk about some of your shortcomings, people are more willing to share theirs.
Okay, that's a good note to end on. Let's take a quick break. You're listening to Cultural Connections on KSL News Radio.
Utah's Morning News jumps out of the gates Monday with the breaking news you love.
All news, all traffic, all weather.
Start your day here, 5 to 9 on KSL News Radio.
Writing to further the conversation on the changing culture of Mormonism, and we have author Russell Stevenson, author of For the Cause of Righteousness, A Global History of Blacks and Mormonism. We have Tamu Smith, who is the co-author of Diary of Two Mad Black Mormons. And we have Margaret Blair Young, screenwriter of Heart of Africa. And I just have to remind you all that Russell Stevenson's book, For the Cause of Righteousness, is published by Greg Coford Books. Diary of Two Mad Black Mormons is published by Desert Book. And the Margaret Blair Young, she's also the one of the co-authors of Standing on the Promises, the trilogy of History of Black Mormon Pioneers. That is the revised and expanded version. You can find it. It's published by Zarahemla, and it's on Amazon. And Margaret, you're also working on Heart of Africa, and we can go to heartofafricafilm.com to find out more information. Well, and before we went to break, we were just talking about Diary of two Mad Black Mormons and how that's being received, Tamu. Let me shift to you here, Margaret Blair Young. How do you feel like your work with Heart of Africa Film, how do you feel like that's helping to further the conversation on the changing culture of Mormonism?
Yeah, but I'll take one step back, because before I did any work on Africans, I never thought that I would be thinking about the African continent. I was writing about Black Mormon pioneers, specifically, well, one of
Black
the
Americans.
Most prominent. Yeah, there were some Africans, but yeah, Jane Manning James. And Tamu was portrayed Jane. She was our dream Jane. She was Jane for about a decade.
Flattery gets you everywhere, Mark.
I know. I calculated that. And President Uchtdorf actually saw the play that I had written and talked to me afterwards. And the lesson I get from this, he has a heightened sense of morality. His conscience guides him.
President Uchtdorf came to see I Am Jane recently.
That's correct, the one that you did at BYU. And afterwards, he talked to me about the first time he came to the United States, and he went to Mobile, Alabama for some flight training, and he saw the segregation, and it was appalling to him that could exist in the United States. That's as people become sensitized to the realities around us, as we not only tell one another stories, but learn to listen to one another's stories and what the narratives really are, not what we imagine them to be, we are able to truly come together in the kind of unity that creates Zion. With Heart of Africa, I'm really excited that the film that's coming out, directed by Garrett Batty, who did the Saratov approach, called Freetown, which was filmed in Ghana, will premiere in Ghana. That, to me, is huge. Our film will premiere in Kinshasa probably next November, Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of Congo. Two films about Mormon missionaries premiering in Africa. And if you just think of the implications of that, for us, I felt it very important to bring film to the Democratic Republic of Congo. So as we film, we will have African interns, because they need to be able to tell their stories. Their stories have been mistold from before Joseph Conrad by people from all cultures, and it's time for them to pick up the microphone and tell who they are and show the joy and the beauty of their culture.
And Russell, as I'm listening to Margaret talk about listening to each other's stories, people in the church listening to each other's stories, your book is A Global History of Blacks and Mormonism. So talk to us about those stories.
Right. And, you know, for a long time when we've talked about, you know, the history of Blacks and, you know, their relationship to the church, it has...
To the Latter-day Saint Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
It has often excluded the African narrative. And when it is told, it is told in a way that it suggests that, you know, you have these people living in Nigeria and Ghana who for years and years and years were preparing to eventually join the church, and that, you know, the transition was seamless. Right, that it was a very easy incorporation into the LDS Church, but as my book shows, you know, there were some points of tension. You know, for example, in Ghana, there was a woman by the name of Rebecca Mould, and she was well regarded within, you know, her newly made Mormon community. She was called the prophetess, and she led her own congregations. She had visions. And everyone regarded her as someone of incredible spiritual spiritual stature on par with other male Mormon leaders of the time. When the LDS Church came to Africa, came to Ghana specifically in 1978, she was placed as the Relief Society president and removed from her position as the leader of the congregation. The ultimate result of that was a pretty severe fracture in the Ghanaian Mormon community. And it was a fracture that it took quite a while for them to heal. They still continue to affiliate with the Mormon Church in some way, but they call themselves really an independent congregation. You know, ultimately, there was a kind of a reconciliation brokered. Last year, Rebecca Mould was given an award, the Pioneer of 78 award by the church. And now there's been some healing. But for a long time, she felt that she was in a good position to lead a congregation, and she wasn't given that authority.
What's going through my head as I'm thinking about some of the political discussions that have happened here in Utah with groups like Ordained Women and...
Well, there's a lot of things going through my mind. I think I was writing down my thoughts as I was listening to these stories. The thought that somebody gets a Pioneer of 78 award and it's not a Darius Gray or a Ruffin Bridge Fourth and it's not a Eugene Orr is kind of funny to me because those were pioneers for me of 78. And I just think, I just think it's very easy for people in the church, especially LDS people, to focus on Africa. And I don't want it to be about Africans versus African Americans. You know, you have these two movies that are focused on Africa, and yet we've yet to see the black narrative in film form in America. And, here is where you have people who interacted with Joseph Smith, and you have black men who had the priesthood and served missions here in America during that time, like during Joseph Smith's time at the genesis of the church. And yet next year we have two movies coming out in Africa. And I'm grateful for the conversation. I think it started, but I also think that as a group, as a collective group in the LDS church, we need to ask ourselves what it is about African Americans that makes us so uncomfortable that we would rather cross the ocean, like go across the desert to tell someone else's story, as opposed to, once again, I feel like the African American sits in the back of the bus and we wait for our story to be told.
And that is a good note to take a break on. You're listening to Cultural Connections on KSL News Radio.
Hi, Brian Martin and Amanda Dixon.
Our job is to get you to work faster on Monday.
We'll break in the second there's a problem.
It's Triple Team Traffic, Monday 5 to 9 on KSL News Radio.
Thank you so much for sticking with us. We are having some very crucial conversations with three Latter-day Saint authors who are writing to further the discussion and conversation on the changing cultures within Mormonism. And we are hearing from Russell Stevenson, author of For the Cause of Righteousness, A Global History of Blacks and Mormonism. That is published by Greg Coford Books. We're hearing from Tamu Smith, co-author of Diary of Two Mad Black Mormons, published by Deseret Book, and Margaret Blair Young, who's a screenwriter of Heart of Africa. You can find more information at heartofafricafilm.com, and also co-author of Standing on the Promises, the Trilogy of the History of Black Mormon Pioneers. And you can find the revised expanded version published by Zarahemla on Amazon. All of these books are available now. And I really appreciate having these crucial conversations because with all that's going on in our country right now, discussions of race, discussions of women in the priesthood, discussions of culture in general within the Latter-day Saint Church, within our communities, I think it's very important to have these crucial conversations. And at times, they are uncomfortable. People seem to be uncomfortable with these hard experiences by other people. And I appreciate what you said, Tamu, about how people are more willing to cross the ocean and talk about African saints, African Latter-day Saints. And there were black Americans here already who were doing the exact same thing long before. Let's continue that conversation.
Well, I think about, there was a little pamphlet that the church gave out years ago, and it's the history of the church. And I think I remember seeing this and discussing this with Margaret. And it talks about the heritage, the history, and it talks about the Black pioneer. And it, when it talks about the first Blacks in the church, it actually names someone in Africa. And for me, it was heartbreaking because, you know, my mother always said that if you know the truth and you do not speak the truth, you're telling a lie. And I thought, why did the church, the LDS church, put this, their stamp on the back of this book, knowing that that actually was not the truth? That's the truth for, it was Nigeria, I think. It was a Nigerian. That's the truth for him. But actually, the truth of the first Black person in our church was not that person. It was actually someone else in America. But we were, because of the shame, the shaming, the slavery, and all of the things that happened, the, you know, priesthood ban, we did not tell that story, the story that we should have told, and the story that is our history. And to me, it was heartbreaking because that means that I have to put out my candle to burn so that someone else's can burn brighter, because the powers that be are embarrassed of my history in the church.
Russell?
And, you know, the reality is, I can't tell you how many times I have been talking to whites in Utah, and I say, well, you know that Utah was actually a slave territory, and they look at me in shock. They had no idea. So I didn't know that was part of our history. And I said, in fact, it is. And yet, we tell these stories time and time again about the Nigerian saints, about the Ghanaian saints, and they're important stories. They were influential
Absolutely,
stories.
Yeah.
But if we tell those stories in order to distract ourselves from our own history here in the United States, then we're going down the wrong path.
Margaret, in fact, you were telling me about a conversation that you had with President Uchtdorf, who was part of the first presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, about the Black American saints, the early saints, Jane Manning James.
And he shared Jane's story with saints in Africa.
Bravo.
Let me tell you, when I went to Africa, I had one of my friends translate Jane's story into French, because I was in French-speaking Africa. And I presented that at a Stake Relief Society gathering. And they were thrilled, but they also wanted more. And in fact, they said, why haven't we heard these stories? So that is part of our responsibility, to get the stories told. They do matter deeply. I had a cousin married into my family who called in some distress and said, Margaret, I've just found out that my ancestors held slaves. And he gave me the names of his ancestors, and I said, oh, yes, I know the family. I'll put a PowerPoint together and introduce you to them. And I had the pictures,
wow.
Had pictures of the slaves. And it was a very uncomfortable time for him because he was having to stretch that narrative, stretch the framework with which he had viewed his ancestry. It is, frankly, one of the things that we have to do for healing. Family history is healing, where, for example, we can find out that there are proclivities or disabilities in the family that we may be dealing with now.
That are uncomfortable?
Yeah. I found out fairly recently that my grandfather was an alcoholic. Well, that happens to have strong resonance in challenges that some of my children have. So knowing that, even though it's an uncomfortable fact, really does empower me to deal with what I need to deal with.
And in your book, Tamu, Diary of Two Mad Black Mormons, you bridge a lot of cultural gaps. I mean, I feel like your book does.
I think that we do. I actually would love to be in a position in the gospel where we actually talk about our history. And it's not Black history in the church. It's not African history in the church. It's just we can go through a timeline and say, you know, and at this time, this is what was happening in this person. And I mean, I do think that it's important to share the race of the people because we are a very visual people. And like Margaret said, when, you know, your genealogy, when you know your history, it brings about healing. What I struggle with is even hearing that President Uchtdorf shared a story about a Black pioneer with those on the African continent and not just at General Conference, because that could heal us. that could heal our church, because we are all hurting. We're all experiencing some stuff right now. And I think that hearing that story come from the top, it actually would touch me in America, as well as whoever he shared it with in Africa at that time. And why is that a story that is being left out of the narrative at General Conference, when it can actually touch all of us? Because in this church, if we can't get it right, I don't know if the world can, because this church has never been separated because of segregation. Like, we never segregated because of race. And that story actually should be one that the church as a whole hears. And when do we get to hear it here in America?
And it's interesting how we select the stories that we do tell ourselves, right? White Latter-day Saints in the United States tend to, they're able to come to grips with the story of Jane in ways that they aren't always able to come to grips with the story of Elijah Abels, for example, who was the first black priest holder in Latter-day Saint history. And it's because women are not given priesthood office. So they're able to say, look at how the African-American community fits so well with Joseph Smith. He loved Jane Manning James. But with Elijah, it's like, well, he held the priesthood. And that suddenly problematizes the narrative that we tell ourselves, that, okay, well, you know, this is a time period in which whites could hold the priesthood, and this is a time period in which blacks could hold the priesthood after 78. The fact that Elijah exists at all makes white Latter-day Saints question their assumptions, and that's a pretty uncomfortable experience for a lot of them.
And I want to go beyond race, though. I just feel like everything that we're talking about, whether it's dealing with race or these stories, I just feel like it can go beyond race.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if you don't go beyond race, then you're really not moving towards becoming a Zion society.
I'm thinking, you mentioned tattoos. I go back to the core religion, pure religion and undefiled before God, is this, that you take care of the widows and the fatherless, you feed the poor. My husband is a bishop in a ward. We live in a fairly lower middle class area, and I was walking the dog on an unusual route and saw a young woman and began talking to her. She had many, many, many tattoos. And at one point I said, well, my husband's the bishop. We live over there if you want to talk to him. And he said, oh, she said, no, I'm talking to the bishop's wife, and here I've got all these tattoos. And I said, that makes absolutely no difference. And she actually has begun coming to our ward. I hope that our ward is typical in the way it has accepted people. A lot of people have talked to my husband about feeling at home. And this is something that any of us who have children who have been through the teenage years or gone beyond, at some point they're going to say, I don't fit in. Most of them mm-hmm. will, except the ones who aren't telling us. It's a big line. I don't fit in. I could have said it for a number of reasons myself. I don't belong here. And a huge part that we have as brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers, we are a people who will take the names of those who have passed on, who have no relation to us in family, and we will represent them in the temple. We have an obligation to represent the mothers and fathers who may not be there, the brothers and sisters who may not be treating this child right, the friends who may be mocking the child so that they feel they don't belong.
Yeah. All right,
Let's take a quick break. Amen. You're listening to Cultural Connections on KSL News Radio.
We respect your time, and on KSL, that means breaking news and traffic as soon as you turn on the radio.
Utah's only all-news morning show.
Listen Monday, 5 to 9 on KSL News Radio.
We're having crucial conversations. We're talking to three LDS authors who are writing to further the conversation on the changing culture of Mormonism. And as you've been hearing, these are very educational, sometimes uncomfortable, but at the end of the day, I hope that it has inspired you to maybe want to learn more about somebody else's history. And I appreciate what you said, Margaret, before we went to break, about how you talked to this young woman who was had tattoos all over the place, and she said, oh no, I was talking to the bishop's wife, and here I am, I have all these tattoos. Because at some point, people, whether they have a lot of tattoos, whether they're a single mom raising kids and they're unmarried, or whether they are, you know, somebody of a different race, they have felt like, as you said, they don't fit in, they don't belong here. You all have an expertise in African and African-American history and that narrative, but I can imagine there are Latter-day Saint histories of Asians, Native Americans, Hispanics, and...
First of all, I want to say, I think that sometimes we get on these pedestals and we talk about the things that kind of get under our skin with the LDS Church. There's lots of things that they do right. I have noticed on the website that now they have this section where they are highlighting some of the pioneers from other areas. And I think that if you're not a person that frequents the website, you won't see that. So you need to go to the website and see what's new there, because there's lots of things there that are new. And there's just this history, this rich history that they're starting to highlight. And I want to just say publicly, I appreciate that, because when someone is doing something good, they never hear about it.
Right.
You know, thumbs up to that.
Absolutely. I mean, I've seen so many pieces in the Pioneers in Every Land segment that have been, you know, useful to me as I tell the story to people, because they come to this conversation assuming that it's a niche topic. It's like, well, it's not a niche topic in the eyes of the church. It's obviously important enough to deserve a web space. You know, as a white heterosexual male in American society, you're talking about getting
He's
out of the comfort
back
zone.
Holding back a laugh right now when you said that.
Oh my gosh!
Now
I am in a very. I have been privileged to be in a very comfortable place, right? I am given a lot of benefits that I do not deserve, right? I could just go through my life without ever asking myself hard questions and just go about my daily business. And then whenever someone brought up hard questions, I would say, wow, that's different than my experience. I'm going to keep going about my daily life, right? That's just one of the unearned benefits of being part of the hegemony of which I am. So my request of those who find themselves in a similar situation to me is that we use those unearned benefits that we have been given to create a conversation to be more inclusive and to further our march and our journey towards creating a Zion society.
Actually, Russell, I think that in the church, you actually can find yourself, like in the world, yes, you have this privilege, but in the church, if you do not rise to a certain level of a calling by a certain age or at a certain age, you actually become invisible.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that,
cultural thing.
You know, it is.
Very
I think
good.
that, you know, we went to Manhattan and we met a young man who had topped out of the singles ward, the young single adult ward, and he was there, and you know, he just, people kept stepping in front of him, and what he said to us, because we invited him to come to dinner with us, he said, did you notice how people stood in front of me, just kept stepping in front of me? And I said, yeah, why did you let that happen? And he said, I feel invisible.
Why did he feel invisible?
Because he was in Manhattan. He's from the Vegas area. He went to school in Manhattan, and he said that, you know, he just really didn't. He felt invisible in the church. And the more I spoke to people, the more I spoke to the people that you would think had a presence. This is a white man who felt invisible in the church, you know, and he had a calling. He said he got sick one Sunday and he called to let him know that he wasn't going to be there. He was in the primary. And the next Sunday, he just didn't go and nobody called him. Yeah. And the next Sunday, he didn't go and nobody called him. And so he just stopped going to church and nobody called him. You know, he said, you know, he spent his 30th birthday in Manhattan by himself because he was in school, and he bought a cake. And he stood on a corner, and this is sad to me, stood on a corner, and he said that he was inviting strangers to have cake with him because that means that his home teachers dropped the ball, the bishop dropped the ball, whoever he answers to dropped the ball. But I actually feel like, and I know people are going to be mad, Bishop, I'm sorry. I live in a place where that actually could happen to me. That could happen to any member in my ward, except for someone in the bishopric, someone in the elders quorum presidency, the relief society presidency, a presidency. If you do not rise, have a certain calling by a certain age, you actually become invisible, Russell.
So that sounds like a cultural, and we have to wrap it up here. So that sounds like a cultural thing. Margaret, your thoughts?
It's a cultural thing.
Absolutely.
I'm just thinking that if my husband's the bishop, that doesn't happen.
Well, your husband's different.
No, the truth is, my husband spends hours and hours making sure that people are okay.
And I know your husband, and I do believe that.
There are some great shepherds out there.
Yes. And that's I think, maybe wrap on this. When my husband was called as a bishop, people tended to say congratulations as though he had applied and gotten the job.
Won the position.
That's the position that she was just talking about.
One of my friends, a Presbyterian pastor, said, I know your husband will be a good shepherd. Mm. And that was perfect. That's exactly. But the truth is, we are all shepherds.
But sometimes we look outside of ourselves for other people to, you know, help give us that validation. But isn't there some responsibility on ourselves, as I'm always asking my listeners to go out there and, you know, experience somebody else's culture, walk in somebody else's shoes, just even for a little bit.
Right. And, you know, this reminds me of a talk that Elder David Bednar gave some time back about being quick to observe. And, you know, that was in the context of, like, when we look at those around us, whether in the church or outside of the church, that we try to observe how their lifestyle might be different from ours, how their story might be different from ours, and that we, to the degree that we're able, try to empathize with that.
Thank you all so much. I really appreciate you making the time to talk to us about how we can get outside of ourselves, learn about other people's histories, other people's cultures, and other people's experiences. You've been listening to Cultural Connections on KSL News Radio.